In May 1770, a 14-year-old girl stood on a small island between two kingdoms, weeping as strangers stripped away everything she owned, her gowns, her jewels, even her beloved pug. This wasn't a kidnapping. It was a wedding ritual. Marie Antoinette was being transformed from an Austrian archduchess into French property, and the message was unmistakable. Her body, her image, her very identity now belonged to France. Yet over the next 23 years, this displaced teenager would turn the very tool of her oppression, fashion, into a weapon of political defiance. Her story reveals how clothing became a battlefield where a powerless queen fought for autonomy in a world that demanded her total submission. Versailles was a glittering prison where aristocrats competed to watch royalty perform mundane tasks. Marie Antoinette discovered that even bathing required an audience of hundreds, despite wearing a long cotton gown. The morning dressing ritual proved worse. Protocol forbade her from dressing herself, and if a higher-ranking princess arrived mid-ceremony, the entire process restarted by rank, leaving her shivering naked while servants juggled her chemise. One freezing morning, she erupted. "Oh, this is odious! What an inconvenience!" Her outburst ricocheted through the palace, damaging her precarious position. Meanwhile, her marriage remained unconsummated for 7 years. Maria Theresa's letters from Vienna offered only relentless pressure. Everything depends on the wife. But how could Marie Antoinette succeed in a role demanding she be simultaneously visible and invisible, worshipped yet powerless? 3 days before her 15th birthday, Marie Antoinette mounted a horse wearing men's breeches, and the court gasped. In French court culture, equestrian dress carried profound political meaning. Since medieval times, the ideal monarch was a warrior king on horseback, a strategy Louis XIV perfected through hunting to showcase authority. Catherine the Great understood this. After overthrowing her husband, she appeared at her first military review astride a horse in a male officer's uniform and feathered tricorn hat. The message was clear: she could do a man's job. Unable to assert authority through pregnancy, Marie Antoinette followed suit. She commissioned portraits showing herself in masculine riding garb, blue habit, breeches, high yellow boots, sitting confidently astride a rearing horse in poses deliberately echoing Louis XIV. Maria Theresa was horrified, warning that riding like a man, dressed as a man, was dangerous as well as bad for bearing children, and that is what you have been called upon to do. Yet this was precisely the point. Marie Antoinette rejected the womanly measure of success through procreation, claiming instead a masculine imperial lineage. Her cross-dressing wasn't frivolous fashion, but calculated political theater, a desperate bid for relevance in a court where she possessed neither her husband's affection nor any official power. At Louis XVI's June 1775 coronation, 12 princes in ermine surrounded him as he received Charlemagne's symbols of power. Yet beneath the jubilation, he gasped, "The crown is hurting me." Meanwhile, 19-year-old Marie Antoinette watched from her grandstand, her face merely the midpoint between her towering powdered hairstyle topped with white feathers and her sapphire-laden gown. Her hair had become a 3-foot-tall political billboard. The pouf, a revolutionary headdress built on wire, cloth, gauze, horsehair, and teased hair, transformed women's appearance into personalized mobile advertisements. Created by Rose Bertin and Monsieur Leonard, these elaborate constructions featured miniature still lifes expressing feelings or commemorating events. Marie Antoinette wielded them brilliantly. Her coiffure, a l'Iphigénie, featured black mourning ribbons and a crescent moon, celebrating Gluck's opera, a tribute to her childhood music tutor and a reminder of her successful cultural intervention against Madame du Barry's opposition. Even more audacious was the pouf à l'inoculation, unveiled after she convinced Louis XVI to undergo smallpox inoculation, common in Austria but controversial in France. The gigantic pouf featured Aesculapius's serpent twined around an olive tree with a golden sun representing Louis XIV's glory. the deliberate ambiguity. Was this glory returning through Louis XVI or through his consort? As she told her brother, "I allow the public to believe I have more credit with the king than I do in reality, because if people didn't believe me on this point, I would have less power still." Her strategy worked. Courtiers commented on her apparent dominion, and ministers showed increased deference. When Louis XVI gifted Marie Antoinette the Petit Trianon in 1774, she transformed it into a locked sanctuary, requiring personal invitation, unlike Versailles, where rank determined access. By withdrawing from scrutiny, she seized control of her image and power. Her fashion was revolutionary. She abandoned restrictive panniers for the robe à la Polonaise with ankle-exposing swags. Most radical was the goal, a white muslin shift from Caribbean colonial wear worn over flexible cloth instead of stays, accessorized with ribbon sashes and unpowdered loose hair. She rejected ostentatious fabrics and jewel tones for bourgeois grays, beiges, and subtle pastels. Between 1783 and 1787, she constructed the Hameau, a picturesque village where royals frolicked among perfumed sheep and drank milk from Sèvres porcelain cups, reportedly molded on her own breasts. The irony was exquisite. By playing peasant, she asserted supreme privilege. All Trianon regulations were issued by order of the queen, an unprecedented feminization of monarchical decree that symbolically transformed even Louis XVI into just another subject. In August 1784, Cardinal de Rohan met a woman in Versailles' moonlit Grove of Venus whom he believed was Marie Antoinette. Dressed in the queen's signature white gull, she gave him a rose before vanishing. This encounter, orchestrated by his lover, Comtesse de La Motte, convinced Rohan the queen favored him. La Motte then claimed Marie Antoinette desperately wanted a 2,800-carat diamond necklace but couldn't purchase it openly. Rohan bought it for 1.6 million livres and gave it to La Motte. When the scheme unraveled in August 1785, Rohan produced a letter signed Marie Antoinette of France. The monarchs immediately identified the forgery, as royal protocol required only Christian names. At trial, France confronted a devastating question. Was Rohan guilty of criminal presumption, or was such behavior plausible from their queen? On May 31, 1786, the Parliament narrowly acquitted Rohan, citing the queen's reputation for frivolity and indiscretion as making her mistake entirely plausible. Her white gull, the same style that had caused portrait scandals, became evidence against her character. Fashion had become her prosecutor. As one observer noted, the revolution was already present in the minds of those who could contemplate such an insult to the king. On October 16, 1793, Republican officials forbade Marie Antoinette from wearing her black mourning gown to the scaffold, fearing it might inspire sympathy. She transformed this indignity into her most brilliant fashion statement. After drafting a farewell letter, she shed her ragged black dress and clothed herself in pristine white. Plum black shoes, fresh white underskirt, clean white chemise, the white déshabille dress from the Kemple, and her prettiest muslin fichu. She removed even the black ribbons from her widow's coif, creating a simple ruffled linen bonnet as colorless as her hair. Pale from blood loss, she became a figure of pure, radiant white, stunning the crowds into silence as she traveled to the guillotine in an open cart. This final ensemble condensed her entire fashionable past into one devastating image, the color of the fleur-de-lis, of bridal complexions, of powdered heads, of the gull, of diamonds and feathers, of the monarchist cockade, of martyrdom and eternal life. White, the color of the pages on which her story would be written again and again. She had spent 23 years using fashion to claim autonomy in a world determined to own her. Even her executioners couldn't control her final appearance. The displaced girl who once wept on an island between kingdoms had the last word, spoken in the universal language she had mastered. The silent, devastating eloquence of what we choose to wear when everything else has been taken away.